Welcome, Alex. Welcome to the show. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your role?
Sure, yeah. I'm an entertainment solicitor at Russells, which is a West End law firm in London, specialising in different fields of entertainment, but mostly music. And within that, a pretty kind of broad range from artists to a lot of independent labels, major labels, publishers, some sort of music technology companies. The whole spread, really, from sort of people who make the music to the people who exploit and distribute it. Yeah, and a pretty broad spread in terms of kind of where people are in their careers on the artist level as well. So from pretty early stage to people who do kind of big tours and sell lots of albums.
Awesome. So let's just jump right into it. I want to ask one question, and it's been bugging me, and I'm sure a lot of artists, because we're going to be focusing on the artist today, because obviously that's our audience and that's who's listening. And it's about poor man's copyright. And I don't know how many times you have come across this, but it's one of the big questions that I personally get asked. So I'm wondering if you get asked the same question of whether it, first of all, it works, because it seems like when an artist is, first of all, just starting up, it seems almost as if that's their go-to. And the idea is obviously poor man's copyright, you'll know, but just for everybody else who's listening, is that you can protect your songs by sending it in the post and sending it back to yourself so that you have a stamp of the date and that's supposed to be protected. Your thoughts, Alex, on that?
Yeah, I mean, so just in terms of kind of copyright law, I mean, in America, they have a registration system, which we don't have here. So it's not like a patent or a trademark where there's somewhere you go and you sort of and you notify them that you have a copyright that exists in your song. So you're right that traditionally one of the ways that people have kind of tried to have some sort of evidence of and sorry, just to finish the thought there, is that copyright subsists automatically. So the minute that I write a song, as long as I've fixed it in some sort of tangible form, so that might be writing it down on a piece of paper, manuscript paper, or recording it, whatever, that copyright comes into existence at that point. And so you don't, if you've done a little demo on your dictaphone or whatever, that there is copyright in that song. The method of that you're talking about of sort of mailing yourself or your lawyer or someone that you sort of trust to keep it safe, your song, that's really an evidential thing. So it doesn't create the copyright. It just gives you a chance later on when somebody else comes along and records something that sounds suspiciously like your song, to be able to pull this one out of a drawer and say, well, hang on, this was dated this, and this shows that I wrote the song already. I mean, I think it's still sensible. It's quite old fashioned. The thing is that now there's probably more evidence, I think, of what people have done. So back in the day, you'd write a song and then you might not have a chance to record it because recording was expensive and difficult to come by, until a big label was willing to pay to put you in a studio or somebody in a studio to record those songs. And so you might have these songs knocking around for a while without any ability to really evidence that they existed before someone else came along and ripped them off. Now most people are putting up their music on SoundCloud or putting it up through some sort of distributor. So if you've got that evidence, that'll work. You've got something that you can prove that you sent some track off to this distributor or this or put it up online at a date and somebody comes along. The fact that it wasn't the sort of the old fashioned way with a stamp on it in an envelope and going to your lawyer doesn't matter.
My other question to you is, what is the biggest mistake that you always see musicians, you know, doing, or something that's happened quite early on in their career? What's the biggest hurdle that you would say, just look, this is the one thing that if I were going to give one piece of advice, this is what it would be?
I think a general observation would be, and there's a theme rather than a specific thing, but like I think people can be uncomfortable having business type conversations around other musicians or around people around them being their manager or their, I don't know, their mate who's putting out the record or whatever. And I totally appreciate that my job puts me at a remove, right? Like it's much easier to negotiate on behalf of someone else than it is to ask for your own pay rise. Or also people find it difficult to have these conversations when it comes to their own affairs. But what often happens is people go into a room and they write a song, and you and I write the song, and I thought you'd came up with a bit of the chorus, but let's face it, I wrote the whole thing in my mind, and you come away thinking actually you wrote the whole thing and I just contributed a bit to the bridge or whatever, and then people kind of come away with different ideas of what happened in the room, and it just causes problems later down the line if you haven't sort of had that conversation now. Because if you have the conversation now, we're not talking about a hit song, we're talking about something we knocked out in a session on a Saturday afternoon. There's no emotional value to it. There's no, we haven't seen that it's already got to number one or something. It's when something's already become an event or there's a success story that suddenly this, the whole thing becomes a mess because everyone's got their own narrative. Everyone's got their own, and sort of to an extension of that sort of thought, I guess, is people being very worried about, I don't know, somebody wants to release their record, they want to sign them. And I think there's a lot of narrative in the music industry around signing as an achievement in and of itself. So like somebody's like, hey, I signed a record deal, and my job is to kind of go, well, that's great, but what does it say? And like a piece of paper is not always, doesn't always, if the artist has just kind of wandered into signing a piece of paper without getting anyone to look at it, anyone to check it over, sometimes there are all sorts of nasties in there. And I think people are just often very flattered by the attention or by the fact that somebody, you know, believes in them, and people say all the right things at the point where they're about to sign. And or sometimes people sign stuff and they know it's not great. And they've got somebody like me sort of saying, well, look, normally the royalty would be this, and it's actually that, which is less good. And I think people often feel embarrassed about asking for what's just standard. My job is quite modest in a sense. Often it's just about knowing what's the ballpark. If you're doing a deal with an independent label, if somebody's getting offered a 25% net receipts royalty, I mean, we can come back to what some of these terms mean, but like, it's just my job to know that that's very low. Actually, you should probably be getting 50. And if somebody's offering less, then you need at least have a conversation with them about why it is and what and why the normal sort of logic doesn't apply. And I think you should never be embarrassed about asking for what everyone else out there is getting. It doesn't make you difficult. It doesn't make you greedy. You're just doing your basic diligence before you sign something that often will tie you in for years and years and years.
100%. And I think you've just touched on something there, which is get all your contracts checked, right? That's something that I feel like, I mean, I've heard horror stories of certain things where people didn't, and obviously it's affected them either immediately or further down the line. So just making sure that all your contracts are checked with someone that's obviously able to, I mean, to put it simply, read the law, because there's so many like nuanced terms and things like that, that I think a lot of the time can be misinterpreted, and then you're stuck, or then you're in a bit of a difficult position. But the other thing that you said there, which is something I wanted to cover, which is what is the industry standard? And like, there's so many things, obviously, with management, and then we've got some of these ballpark figures. I mean, I know there would be quite a lot if we kind of go into the whole of the music industry, but is there anything that you can kind of give anybody to, if someone's just literally just hearing about this for the first time, what's the best, you know, either they can find out about it or from your own knowledge, what we can do to kind of, you know, break that down a little bit more?
I mean, I think there are different types of deals, obviously, but you could probably bucket them all. So there's the deals which start to look a bit like they're a bad idea to sign are the ones which combine stuff that is usually separate. So what I mean by that is if you sign a record deal and the record company wants to own your songs as well, is that a record company that has the skills and the know-how and the contacts to actually be a music publisher, or are they just grabbing something for free that they didn't pay you for? And so the record industry is quite, I mean, it's the costs have come down, but it's quite cost intensive, right? So traditionally you needed somebody to put you in a studio, however many pounds an hour. They needed to press up a load of vinyl and CD. They needed to get a load of people with trucks to drive those CDs and vinyl around the country. And then they had to pay for people to market those records. That was expensive. And so it takes some time for people to make money back from recording. Music publishing is a much more profitable industry, and it's the amount of money involved is smaller, but it's much more quickly into profit. So if you're signing a deal where your record company is taking your publishing rights, it probably means that there's a load of publishing income that you should have been paid that's being used to repay all the costs of that person driving a van around and marketing a record. So there's some things like that where sort of income streams get what we call cross-recouped. In terms of more general stuff, I mean, there's producer agreements and then sort of variations on that theme. So producers, mixers, featured artists all do similar sort of types of deals. And then another area I do quite a lot of is sort of people buying and selling catalogs and things like that. But that comes at the end of your career, really. Or once you're sort of much more established artist, you might have a company that wants to buy your songs and pay you a lot of money for those sort of deals. So I don't know if you want to, we could take each one of those in turn or.
Yeah, well, I think management is obviously the standard kind of 20%. If there's anything lower or higher than that, obviously needs to be looked at and kind of taking a chunk out of that. So that one's a little bit straightforward. Well, it should be.
Come back to that one, actually. So management, people talk about 20%, but again, a lot of my job is people say 20% and my job is to say of what. And so in management agreements, generally managers get paid on gross income, but they don't quite. So once you start to dig into those agreements, if your manager is taking 20% of your live gross income, then you might find that you're doing a lot of touring that's not making any money and the manager's still getting to walk out with 20% of the gate receipts. That's not how it's meant to work. Traditionally, managers get paid on net income on lives, for example. So if you're running tours at a loss and the manager believes in you and you've got a properly negotiated management contract, they should be standing behind those costs and be willing to wait until the money is the tours are profitable before they start dipping into your income. In a lot of other income streams, I tend to think of it as sort of the ones where traditionally you just get paid. Like traditionally people did record deals and publishing deals, they get paid or they wouldn't get paid, but they weren't the people incurring all the costs. They weren't the people pressing up the records or marketing the records. So those ones where effectively gross and net income are more or less the same, managers get paid on gross income. But sure. Yeah, there are certain things that managers shouldn't be commissioning, even if it's income that's coming to you. That's,
I think so.
A lot of the technicalities involved in the management contract is sort of working through those. So
remember to get your contracts checked every time. But let's go back to, I think it's important to talk a little bit about publishing, because there's so many different things. When you're first starting out, it's about being able to evaluate, obviously, your songs. And I think an industry standard is obviously quite useful. And also right at the beginning of your career, you're obviously collaborating with a lot of different people. So the first thing is that what happens if there's a dispute? And also I was under the impression that a lot of industry standards didn't actually apply to the collaborative work that went on between, like, you know, producers and songwriters. It was always kind of a unanimous agreement. I don't know if I'm saying that word, and between the collective and then being able to then go ahead and publish all of that. So it's interesting that you bring that up, because I didn't know that.
So producer is a term, it's not a legal term. Well, when I say that, it is actually. There's the word producer is used in copyright law, but in a way that none of us in the music industry would recognize. So we put that aside. But the word producer, it kind of depends what genre you're in, right? So if you're a pop producer, if you're talking about the Beatles, for example, George Martin was somebody who was kind of like the equivalent of a film director or playing that sort of role, right? So somebody comes in with a finished song, and then there is like a script, and then somebody needs to realize it. The musicians perform the recording, and the producer is the person who kind of sort of stage manages that whole production of creating a realized, fully mixed recording of a song. If you're talking about like hip hop, producers get used in a slightly different sense, where like actually the process is almost the other way around, right? So in like a lot of hip hop and other musics which are kind of beat based, a producer is somebody who will write beats, will write effectively the underlying bed of the music. So they're songwriters as much as producers, and then a rapper will come in and rap over the top. So it kind of, in terms of whether your producer gets a share of songwriting, and just to go back to real basics, there's, in that example I gave of the George Martin thing, there's quite a clear separation there between song and recording, right? So the song is Yesterday, and it's Yesterday whether I perform it, you perform it, or Paul McCartney performs it. It's the same song. It's got the same lyrics and it's got the same melody. and the same chord progression. The recording, and there's a copyright in the underlying song, which is what the publishing industry is built on. That it's an industry that exploits and monetizes and finds uses for those song copyrights. The record industry is the industry that is involved in producing and monetizing and exploiting recordings people make of songs. So if I was Paul McCartney, my publisher would own, or you know, to sort of get into this in a sec, but you know, my publisher would be involved in the song, mm-hmm. and my record company would be involved in the recording I made of that song with the Beatles, but they wouldn't necessarily be involved in a recording that someone else made, even though each time it's my publisher that's collecting income from the uses of those songs in various different recordings in various different contexts. So in terms of like whether a producer gets a share of the songwriting, sort of depends on have they actually written any of the song, or are they just involved in realizing a recording of that song? And then in terms of kind of whether it's with a producer or just co-write, just people in a writing session, whether people, what cut you get, I mean, there's no great magic to it in practice. Like it's a sort of gut feeling people have about who contributed what. There are certain kind of conventions that, again, going back to kind of hip hop, there's a sort of convention that if you're the rapper, you get half, and if you're the producer, you get half. It's not always true. And then sometimes people agree splits that have nothing to do with their actual contributions. I think Elvis Presley's manager was quite famous for getting Elvis Presley cuts on songs he hadn't had anything to do with writing. But you'd think, well, if you're a songwriter and you've written a song, do you want it to go to number 99 on the charts with somebody no one's ever heard of? Or do you want it to go to number one with Elvis and give him half? It's just an assessment you kind of have to make. So, and it kind of goes back to what I was saying before, which is kind of try and get it agreed in the room. And it can feel uncomfortable, I think, because if people are writing and it's a purely creative discussion, suddenly gets their sheets out and sort of goes, right, I was 20%, you were 80%. But professional songwriters do that. They learn the hard way that that's the way to do it.
Yeah, someone told me a little bit about, sorry, just off the back of that, they told me that the best way to do it and kind of segue is always to kind of even follow up straight after the session, saying, like, thanks so much, it was a great session. And
just don't wait until it's gone to number one, because then you'll find that everyone's suddenly mysteriously written the whole thing.
Yeah, it's true. It's really true. Sorry, you were saying.
I know. And then if you want to sort of talk about what publishing deals look like, do you want to go into that? So publishing is your publisher will register your songs and go around and make sure that all the uses of your songs are being recognized, and that all of the money that's payable, and it can get very labyrinthine and complicated. And I don't know if your music got played on a radio station in Japan or in a cafe in Italy or whatever, there should be some income in each case that attaches to your share of the song that should trickle its way back through different countries and different routes back to you. And it can be very hard, unless you have somebody keeping on top of that job, to get all of that income. There's a lot of sort of uncollected income that unsigned writers will have. In terms of deals, there's sort of two types of deals, really. There's a sort of traditional publishing deal where the publisher is more active and might be trying to put you in sessions and go off and find you opportunities. So they might either find you opportunities to write new songs or find opportunities for your old songs. So they might be picking up the phone to people involved in making films and syncing songs, trying to drum up some income that way. Or you might have a more sort of passive type deal where you've got really just them administering your song, where they might not be doing all the sort of the more active stuff. Their role is more limited to the collection, the registration, and the basic sort of making sure the money finds its way home to you. And basically, if they're the more active they're being, the bigger chunk of the income they're going to want to take. And sort of rule of thumb tends to be, it sort of crept up over the years, but for a new writer, you'd probably be getting paid 75% of the income on a sort of active traditional publishing deal, and it's more in the sort of 90% kind of ballpark for an admin type arrangement.
Yeah, that's That's what I was going to get to, was where is the figure that it becomes extortionate? So that's the kind of, if there was a 50-50, you'd obviously have to really dive into that and be like, well, really, what's justifying that?
Yeah, I mean, and there used to be, publishing deals used to be 50-50. If you kind of go back and look at what some of these, sort of the Beatles and Elton John and people like that were signing, they would give away half the money to the publishers. And that has just crept up over the years.
Well, and the last question that I have is all about protecting yourself as an artist. What is the biggest thing that you can do to make sure that you are recognized for your own work? Really broad. So interpret how you will.
Well, there's a tension here because, I mean, you speak to some people sometimes and they sort of say, look, how can I make sure no one steals my song? And the best answer to no one stealing your song is no one hears it, right? So ultimately the aim is to get your music out there. So really, I think it sort of goes back to what we started with, which is try and make sure that there's some agreement between the people involved in the creative process about who owns what, and then try and make sure that there's some sort of evidence that you can rely on looking back that you did what you say you did on the date you did it. And after that, I mean, the fact is that there's a very famous case in the States involving the Marvin Gaye estate and Pharrell and Robin Thicke, the Blurred Lines case, where there was a sort of a bit of a weird decision made by a jury. So in America, a lot of these big copyright cases get decided by juries, which we find quite strange over here, because lay people are being asked to make a complicated kind of combination of decisions about quite technical legal questions and also quite technical musicological questions. And sometimes they can reach quite unpredictable answers. And the answer in the case that they kind of gave in this case was that a song that sort of had the same sort of mood or vibe as the original Marvin Gaye song was found to be infringing, which is not traditionally how we think of copyright infringement as working. We think it's really about copying the actual lyrics or the actual melody in a much more sort of tangible way. Because if somebody could have a monopoly on the blues or a monopoly on, I don't know, EDM or something, everyone else would have to down tools and would never be able to write another song in that genre again. So And the fact is that has encouraged a lot, especially in the US, of a pretty kind of speculative litigation, where if you're big enough and successful enough, somebody will mysteriously discover that they actually wrote your song before you did. There's not much you can do about that. One of the things that a publisher will do, if you have a decent publisher, is they will protect your composition. So it'll be their job to fight that litigation, and then if it's successful, they'll sort of share the proceeds. So a publisher can help in that regard as well. But I think it's really, as I said, just about trying not to have sort of needless arguments with your co-writers, and trying not to be in a situation where you've written something and you can't prove that you've written it because you had no record of it existing.
100%. So check the contracts, get everything done early, as early as possible. And also, I think it's important to note that there are different laws around the world, right? There's different territories. And so in terms of understanding what those laws and those rights are, it's really important. Obviously, most of the artists that we work with are in the UK, but obviously the next thing is obviously the US as well, checking those terms too. So Alex, where can everybody find you, and what can they reach out to you for as well?
What can they reach out to me for? I mean, probably the easiest thing is to look at my firm's website, Russells, RUSSELLS. You can find me on the website. I try not to sort of play out my role too much, in the sense that I think some lawyers sort of sell themselves on the basis that they can sort of make your career happen for you, or they can pick up the phone to the right person and suddenly you're signed to a £1 million record deal. I try not to get people's hopes up in that way, because I mean, we deal with a lot of people at a lot of labels, and we know people who are involved in the music industry. But at the end of the day, I'm a lawyer. People don't ask me for my opinion on the middle eight, because that's not what I've spent, you know, the last few years specializing in. And so really, I kind of see my role really as sort of helping with the business side and helping with the kind of the contracts. And if somebody has five labels chasing them, we can probably help them find a sixth and get that sort of bidding war heated up. But I think it's important, and especially in this kind of DIY world that we now sort of find ourselves in, where people can just make music and put it upline, and don't wait for someone else to make your career happen for you. I think that's the sort of a sort of 80s mentality that's probably out of date now. I think if you're doing the right things and you're finding an audience and you're playing gigs, I appreciate it. We're not living in the sort of normal world at the moment in terms of gigging, but you can do that. You can do all the things that people know to do to get your music out there and get it heard, and successful follow that way.
Yeah, I think if you've got people behind you, then obviously you're always going to be a success. So yeah, thanks so much, Alex, anyway, for speaking to us, and I'm sure we'll put some details down so everybody can find you as well. But yeah, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.